Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
And we've been following this case involving a DNC staffer who was murdered on the streets of D.C. back on July 8th. It's a very interesting case, and it got a little more interesting yesterday when Julian Assange with WikiLeaks in a television interview suggested that perhaps, he didn't come out and say it, he hinted, and it's sort of weaselly of him, but this is what he said.
Our whistleblowers go to significant efforts to get us material and often very significant risks. As a 27-year-old who works for the DNC, who was shot in the back, murdered just 2 weeks ago for unknown reasons as he was walking down the street in Washington. So
That was just a robbery, I believe, wasn't it?
No, there's no finding. So
What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that our sources take risks. And they become concerned to see things occurring like that.
And so his hint was that perhaps this young man who worked at the DNC might have been one of the sources for the release of WikiLeaks documents that came from the DNC. Let's separate fact from fiction. Let's try to find out what we do know. Joining us on the line right now, Rod Wheeler, former D.C. homicide detective. Rod, what do we know about this case? I mean, even if you set the Assange stuff aside, this is an unusual case.
Right. Good morning to you guys. What I can tell you is that I actually walked the crime scene yesterday. Now, this actual crime occurred on the early morning of July 10th. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:19 to be precise, and it happened up in the Bloomingdale area of Washington, D.C., the northwest area. So just to real quickly give the listeners the lay of the land, we're about 3 miles or 3 blocks over from Howard University, okay? And so this is an area that has had about 17 robberies this year alone, the Bloomingdale area. So it's not unusual. It's not totally unusual to see street robberies occur. Now, the individual was on his way home. He was about a block away from where he actually lives. And the police, my sources are telling me that they believe he was approached by two other individuals who attempted to rob him. Now, what makes this, Brian, a little bit peculiar is the fact that the victim's wallet, his watch, his ring, and things were still on his body. But that doesn't mean that it was not a robbery. It still could have been a robbery. What I believe real quickly happened, I think the guy, the victim, Seth, tried to fight his assaulters, the two individuals, off, and I think he tried to get away, and then that's why they winded up shooting him in the back.
So it's not unusual, then, for a robbery, an attempted robbery, to end up in a murder with the victim shot in the back and all of the person's valuable possessions still lying there on his body?
Right. That's not unusual at all, Larry. And here's why. Because typically, if a person fights off or attempts to fight off their attackers, like I believe the victim did in this case, and as a matter of fact, the medical report and his father, which went over to the medical examiner's office to look at his body, everybody said that he had bruises on his knees.
Ah.
I'm talking the victim now. He had bruises on his knees and his face. So it was apparent that he was in a fight of some type with these individuals. So that's why I think he tried to get away, and then that's how he ended up with the gunshots to the back. Hey, one other thing real quickly, guys, I'm going to share with you all. If this was a hit, let's say a professional hit as being suggested by some of these conspiracy theorists, right? A professional hitman would not engage in a fight on a street with the individual that they're trying to kill. Mm. This would have been an execution-style murder. That's not the case here with this case.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised though. If you have a fight with a guy and you want to rob him, and he starts to run away and you shoot him in the back, why don't you then take a second longer to get his wallet? If it was a robbery,
right? Because see, what happens is. And that's an excellent question. On the street, when you deal with some of these individuals on the street, if you resist them, and that's why we tell people all the time, in a street robbery, don't resist. Because now what has happened this guy, the robber, is upset, and it's more personal now, so he just wants to kill you. He doesn't care about your wallet at that point. He just wants to kill you because you attacked him. And I think that's what happened in this case. Seth was fighting for his life, and I think he probably struck this assailant once or twice, and then that's when he was trying to get away. So they don't care about your wallet at that point, guys. All they want to do at that point is just kill you.
Rod Wheeler, I'd love for you, since in your career you have dealt with the victims or families of victims of murder, and I'd love for you to speak to this issue of what it means to the family when they hear all these conspiracy theories floated out in the news. I have a person who was very close to me who died. He was a high-profile person, and there are still conspiracy theories reaching all the way up to the White House about how he died, and all of it is false, but people make money off of this stuff. Tell me about how the victims and their families react to this and why it is so hurtful.
Yeah, it's very hurtful, and you know what? The reason it's so hurtful is because people make suggestions about things that they don't know. It's like pulling straws out of the sky. They don't have the evidence. You know, they're just making up these conspiracies. And what happens is family members of the decedent, family members of the loved ones that's been killed, you know, they hear these things and it just stays in their mind all the time. So it's really unfortunate. And that's why I would always caution our listeners, you know, be careful when you hear these conspiracy theories. Now, regarding this particular case with the DNC staffer, I can tell you firsthand, and I spoke with the detectives yesterday, they actually looked at that relationship that he had with the DNC to see if there was any link. And you know what they tell me, guys? There was absolutely no link found whatsoever. Now, the case is still wide open, so that doesn't mean that they're not going to revisit that at some point. But for right now, that's just more of a theory. The working theory right now that the detectives are using is that this was a street robbery. The night that this individual was killed, July 10th, just so that you know, about an hour before this incident took place, two other individuals were robbed less than a mile away at gunpoint right here in the same Bloomingdale area.
All right. Well, listen, Rod Wheeler, that's why we turned to you, to help us understand these things better. And thank you so much for being here.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
And Lisa Booth is in. You see her on Fox News all the time. She's a contributor over at the Washington Examiner. And I'm Brian Wilson, and she's Lisa Booth. And he...
It's a beautiful song.
...is Trevor Maddich, former elite snapper for the Washington Redskins, here to give us a sense of how they looked last night during the preseason game, the first preseason game. By the way, we can watch this on Facebook Live as we're streaming it, because we do that when people come in studio.
Nice.
When we come in studio, we put you on camera.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm shy, though. Now I'm all nervous.
Yeah, you didn't bring your makeup and all that.
Well, actually, you don't know that.
Me either.
All right, Trevor Maddich. So, look, let's start off, first of all, by talking about Kirk Cousins. Wasn't in the game very long. But you have said already in preseason training camp, he looks pretty good. He did one drive. How did he come out?
He was great. He was crisp, and he made complex things look simple. In other words, by having the right timing on the throws, knowing where to put the ball, not just where to put it, though, but when it needs to arrive there, he completed all five of his passes, 5 for 5. Mm-hmm. Now, was anything spectacular down the field? He beat double cut? No, nothing like that. But Cousins will succeed as a Redskins quarterback by doing exactly what he did last night, which is to be a game manager, distribute the ball, get it there on time. And I was impressed with how crisp he was and how decisive he was. Now, first preseason game, I understand that. But in this first preseason game, he passed with flying colors.
So you would say that you like that?
Love that. Love that. Here's why, though.
Why?
RG3, bless his heart, and may he do well in Cleveland, except for when they play the Redskins. RG3 always tried to be the hero playmaker. Mm-hmm. Even when there wasn't anything there to be had, he would run around, extend the play, try to make a huge play every time. That got him injured. That created turnovers. And it made the offense work like a bad college offense, not like a crisp Tom Brady-like NFL offense. And
right.
You see the opposite style with Cousins.
It was exciting to watch at times, but it's not good for the longevity of the quarterback to play like that.
Well, no, and that's the thing. Cousins, he signed a $20 million franchise, one franchise tag, 1 year deal, right?
Mm, right.
Next year, keep in mind that Brock Osweiler left Denver to go to the Texans, signed a contract for $37 million guaranteed dollars.
Right.
Andrew Luck of Indianapolis
right.
signed a contract with $87 million
wow.
guaranteed dollars. So if he stays healthy and plays well, two things. He will be somewhere in between that in terms of guaranteed money. But he stays healthy, not by trying to avoid injury. That's a good way to get hurt. He stays healthy by being decisive and getting the ball out.
Right.
And that's what he did last night.
All right. So they lost the game. The final game against the Falcons was 23-17 Falcons. But we don't care so much about the final score in preseason because we're looking at people, right?
Right.
So who surprised us? Who disappointed us?
Well, who was great was second-round draft choice rookie linebacker Sua Cravens out of USC. He was phenomenal. When I watched him on tape at USC last year, he played faster than he actually runs on the track. He's not a blazing speed guy when he's running a 40-yard dash. But he plays football so fast because he is decisive. He would recognize what he saw and then hit it right now. He wouldn't have any kind of hesitation. He would go, and he showed that in this game where he kept getting behind the line of scrimmage and upending ball carriers before they could turn the ball upfield and get started. Because when he saw what he saw, he attacked it immediately. And I'll tell you, that kind of aggression will be a playmaking capability that the Redskins sorely need on that defensive side of the ball.
So for those of us who didn't get a chance to watch the game last night, what were some of the big plays or what are some of the big takeaways that we should know?
Well, special teams, Lisa, were up and down. The punter, Tressway, was phenomenal. The kickoff coverage gave up a 101-yard kickoff return for a touchdown. But it's one of those things that in the preseason, it's coachable and correctable, and I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. As I watched that play, there was a young Redskins guy trying to make the team as a special teamer who ran down right in the middle of that line, right where they hit it for a touchdown, and he spun twice. In other words, he's being blocked. He spun 360 degrees one way, then 360 degrees back the other way, right. And then the ball carrier ran right past him. Now, when you spin, you turn your back to the ball carrier. A massive no-no on kickoff coverage. So this is the kind of thing they'll be able to coach.
All right, and so given the whole look of the thing, how confident are you about this coming season? I mean, obviously, some people we saw last night are not going to be on this team, but as you look at the people who are likely to make up the core of this team going forward, are you optimistic?
Very encouraged, partly because the secondary is one place that they had to improve, and so
right.
they brought in Josh Norman, massive free agent,
and they did well as long as the first string was in, I'm told, right?
They did,
yeah.
And they brought in some other free agents as well, and Matt Ryan, a Pro Bowl quarterback for Atlanta, didn't complete a pass. He was 0-for-4. They pressured him in the pocket without having to blitz. All this bodes very well for that starting defense. Offensively, the passing game was crisp, but here's the problem.
Yeah.
The running game.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Didn't bust a grape. They didn't bruise a Falcon, and they really didn't even break a sweat. And the running game has got to figure out how to do better because they looked soft.
Is there any way to fix that?
Well, we'll find out. Because the way the collective bargaining agreement is, you can't practice in pads, full contact in training camp as much as you used to be able to.
Okay.
And so you would see them, especially on the runs on the outside, just poor. They weren't matched up and doing the right things on the defenders. So the defenders were running free out there. So the running backs had nowhere to run. And what they ended up doing was they would just sort of run into a defender and fall down. You didn't see any fight out of the running backs in the first half. In the first half of this game, the running backs carried the ball 8 times.
Yeah.
And gained a combined 4 yards.
4 yards.
That's 18 carries. Inches per carry, right? Now, there was no place to
Sounds
run
promising.
A lot of the time. Yeah, not so good. When you're talking
Super Bowl bound.
There was no place to run a lot of the time. But when there's nowhere to run and you're a running back, you need to show your coaches, your teammates, and all the rest of the NFL on tape that you're going to pile drive
you're gonna do
into
your
that
bet,
pile,
yeah, yeah.
And you're going to move it. You're not just going to say, oh, well, nowhere to run. I just got bumped. I'm falling down today. So the running backs need to show a bit more I don't want to say the word courage. They need to show some more violence.
I really am sensing that this is a different year, and this is a different team, and this is a coach who has his act together, and this is an owner who is acting in a different way with the way he handles the team. I don't want to get real excited, but I'm really optimistic about this season.
Yeah. The culture that you're talking about, Brian, is what the difference is. And really it starts with Scott McLuhan, the general manager. He has instituted a grinding love of football in that organization. And the players that he's drafted, the free agents that he's brought in, share a couple of things in common. One is they're generally huge people. I mean, even free agent safety David Bruton that they signed from Denver, he's a mountain of a safety. He looks like he could be playing outside linebacker. He loves huge people. The second thing about those people is that they love the grind of football. Too often in this town, we've brought in big-name people, players, who see football as a stepping stone to advance their personal brand. These guys, they love being in the weight room at 6 in the morning. They love being with their teammates in the meeting room and the practice field. They love that part of football. And so you can have a team that's very talented, but not be a very good team. You can have a less talented team that is a better football team. And the Redskins right now are working towards having talent and being a good football team because of that culture.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Trevor Maddich, I really appreciate you coming in the studio.
It's great to be here.
Hail to the Redskins.
Yeah, hail the Redskins, and I'm looking forward to this season.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. More of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
It's a shoulder lead for Ledecky. She is heading to the wall, and it's going to be Katie Ledecky claiming gold in the women's 200-meter freestyle, 153.73.
That's just another gold medal for Katie Ledecky. That was on Tuesday night, and she's set to win some more gold tonight, and it's just an amazing story. Of course, Michael Phelps, a legendary story, but I think we're watching a legend in the making.
I think so,
with
too.
Katie Ledecky here, only 19 years old, of course, local girl. And we are fortunate enough to speak with one of her coaches from right here in the Washington, D.C. area, Sue Chen. Sue, are you there?
I started coaching at Nation's Capital in March of 2015. So I've been with Bruce for just about almost a year and a half. So I kind of got in, you know, in the middle of all this wonderful stuff happening.
Wow, it's amazing. And tell me what her training is like. How do you train for, because it looks like she's doing something that no one else on our team or anywhere else in the world has figured out how to do.
I know, and she's absolutely spectacular. You know, Bruce refers to her training a lot as, you know, her how she trains consistently every single day, and it's trained behavior. And what I mean by that is, she takes every little thing she does at practice and makes it 100%. And I'm talking the little things, the, you know, the last turn off of every 200 at swim practice. She does a tremendous amount of dolphin kicks and doesn't breathe, you know, the last 8 to 10 strokes going into the wall. And she's just trained herself at you know, in every little thing at practice to make it perfect. So it's not like she trained 40 hours a week in the water and just grind yard. She makes the most out of every minute she's in the water. And I think that's the difference between Katie and other people.
You know, I don't do the swim thing. I do the soccer thing with my daughter. But I mean, you do see these kids that come across your path and you look at this and you say, wow, now that kid is an athlete. That kid's going to be something. When did you first feel that way about Ledecky?
Well, I think you look at Katie and yeah, she's tall, right? I mean, she's just about 6 feet tall. But you would not look at her, and she's not muscle-bound, crazy woman. I mean, she's incredibly strong, but you wouldn't look at her and think, man, that girl's an athlete. I mean, if she was dressed in clothes walking down the street, you would probably not give her a second thought.
Hmm.
Again, it comes back to deliberate practice. I mean, consciously making an effort every day and deliberately doing the small things to practice. So when she gets to a swim meet, you know, she's on autopilot. She just doesn't need to think about it. You know, we talk to our little kids about Katie a lot, and we just say Katie gives herself, probability-wise, she gives herself the highest chance of success when she gets to a meet because she does everything right, whether or not she didn't get enough sleep, whether or not she doesn't feel good, whatever it is, she always puts in the effort. And that's a hard thing to do every day, to try to wake up and be better than you were yesterday every day of your life. I mean, that's tough.
You mentioned Bruce. I'm guessing you mean Coach Bruce Gemmel, is it pronounced?
Yes,
Georgetown,
Bruce Gemmel.
Georgetown prep location for Nation's Capital Swim Club. And tell me, when she's going through your training, when you're doing all these various meets with the swim club, how important are the Olympics? I mean, it's the pinnacle. I mean, this is what Americans focus on every 4 years. Is this always in the back of your mind? Is it always the goal? And is it discussed about this is all about the Olympics? We're all gearing toward the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always in the back of my mind and Katie's mind and Bruce's mind for sure. But I think you can't look too forward. And I'll tell you what, Katie never takes anything for granted. I mean, she had it in her head, but she wouldn't sit here and just kind of assume that she was going to make the Olympics. I mean, she took the trials like everybody else did. You know, she was, mm-hmm. she had to make the team. She had to get her hand on the wall first or second. She knew she had a job. You know, so it's definitely the biggest goal in everybody's brain. But honestly, if you don't start with the little things at practice, then that goal, you know, your probability of success is what I say. The probability of success at the Olympics isn't going to be as high as it is now.
Well, she certainly had a nice rally in that 4x200 relay race, where apparently the speed she added in her leg of the relay was pretty amazing. I mean, she started behind. She ended up like almost 2 seconds ahead.
Must have been going nuts last
night. I bet
you
were going crazy. And what, have you ever seen a burst of speed like that?
Yes, I have, and I've seen it by Katie at practice, which is another funny thing. I mean, when she's racing at practice, whether it's, you know, Andrew Gemmel, who is an Olympian himself, or, you know, we have national age group record holders at our practice, she will put her head down and she will get her hand on the wall first.
All right.
And sure, there are some days where Bruce and I and another assistant coach, Matt, we just kind of sit back and watch her and enjoy these moments that we have at practice, because she thrives on that, man. She's like a bull in a bullpen, just waiting to, like, explode. Those are the situations that Katie loves.
All right. Sue Chen is an assistant coach over at Nation's Capital Swim Club, and I bet there's a whole lot of junior Olympians who were inspired by Katie Ledecky. Real fast, we're out of time, but how young is too young, and when can they start knocking on the door over at the Capital Swim Club there?
Anybody is welcome. You know what I mean? I mean, if you're interested, come on over.
Get it started now. All right. Excellent. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations. Yeah. Enjoy this. Enjoy
thank
this.
You. We will.
We are, too.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Larry O'Connor alongside Brian Wilson.
And joining us on the line right now is our good friend KT McFarland, national security analyst and all-round bon vivant. Hello, how are you doing, KT?
Bon vivant, that's terrific. Thank you.
Take it if you get offered it. Listen, I can't help but say, KT McFarland, national security analyst, there's this story out there of some 50 Republicans who come from the national security defense arena who have signed a letter saying that they just can't support Donald Trump because they think that Trump would put the nation's security at risks. How do you feel about that? Is this something you have thought about? Is this something you think is an overreaction? Most of these people, I should say, have served in the cabinet of President George W. Bush.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know a lot of those people. Some of them are really good friends, and I respect them all. But they are the establishment Republicans, and that's the status quo. And what I guess concerns me about the letter and other letters like it and other national security experts who have come out and said, never Trump, I'll never help him. Well, what happens? What's plan B? What happens if he does win? Despite your letter, what happens if the American people do elect that person? He's going to needle all the experts to give him the advice and the steady hands. And if they're saying, look, I'm never Trump, then I think it's a disservice to the nation that if it is President Trump, would they then not offer their guidance and their helping hand, their collective wisdom? So I think that's one point. But then the second point is, you know, look, I think we have a unique historic moment in the United States and in the world. And that is a unique historic moment like to rethink national security policy, the same way that Nixon and Kissinger rethought it in the 1970s,
right,
opening to China, the same way Reagan rethought it in the 1980s, that instead of just having an existence with the Soviet Union in a Cold War, we'd win the Cold War, we'd use economic means to win it, and we would rethink mutually assured destruction and think about strategic defense against nuclear weapons. So I think we're at one of those inflection points now because the United States has options we didn't have 5-10 years ago.
Can I say what bothers me about it is that it's just a lot of hand rubbing? Oh, we don't like Donald Trump, and then they also say we don't like Hillary either.
Well, but you know, sometimes in life you got to make a choice.
Yeah,
and I think that the as far as who are these people and what role could they play? Well, they've taken themselves out of the option of playing a role in any future administration, mm-hmm, either Hillary's or Trump's. And they're establishment thinkers. I mean, that is the status quo. And by very definition, the status quo and establishment doesn't think outside the box. And I think it's a unique historic moment for thinking outside the box,
like
for rethinking the Middle East, rethinking our relationship with Russia, rethinking how we've let China push us around. And so I'm sorry to see those people opting out of that rethinking process.
KT, there's been frosty relationships between Russia and Turkey, most specifically, personally, between Putin and President Erdogan of Turkey, over border disputes, over the Kurds and the war against ISIS, and there have been various issues over the last year or so. They just met face-to-face, shook hands, and they both vowed to mend their broken relationship. Am I wrong in thinking that's not necessarily good news for us?
No, it's definitely not good news for us. But, you know, these guys have had a sort of, they're like teenagers. I mean, they get along for a while, and then they don't get along for a while, and they get along for a while, and they're going to be best friends forever until tomorrow. So I'm not sure that this is the permanent relationship. However, you know, the chess pieces on the global chessboard are moving around. What's the new relationship with Russia and China? Is there a new relationship with Russia and Iran or Russia and Turkey? Is Europe in a different place? That's why I think that we the United States, we the nation, should have a debate about where do we see America and where do we see America's role in the world going forward. I think Hillary Clinton is the status quo.
Yeah.
Trump, the thing I like about Trump is he offers at least the opportunity to rethink. Will he do so or not? Will he seize the historic moment like Nixon, Kissinger did, like Reagan did? Who knows? But at least he has the option, because you know Hillary won't. So
yeah.
Will Trump? Who knows?
But did we, the U.S., miss an opportunity here as these two were sort of battling? And we do have a couple of common enemies, or is this sort of like one of those really bad choices where you really don't want to be on either side of Erdogan or Putin?
Well, Erdogan is our NATO ally and partner, so we've got that relationship.
Yeah, but his anti-Israeli positions have been troublesome.
And Erdogan, again, is like a teenager. Sometimes he likes Israel, sometimes he doesn't like Israel. But I think that the U.S. has the opportunity, because we are going to be in a great position of economic dominance if we do certain tax cuts, if we allow all the new innovations, the disruptive innovative technologies to be manufactured, at the same time that Russia and China and other economies are slowing down, that it is our game. It is our, we have the high hand, we have the best cards in the game. were we to choose to use them, and that may be to rethink the relationship with Russia,
yeah.
China, et cetera. Look, we got five enemies right now, right? And I think that's a lot.
So I want you to revisit something that is very much the whole spate of stories that have coming out in the last 24 hours about the relationship between the Clinton Foundation and the State Department when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, and how, you know, there were deals that were being cut, and there's a lot of collusion between the foundation and the State Department. What is the danger in a situation like that? Help us understand how dangerous it is when there is a perception of, or actually is, pay for play.
Yeah, you know, I mean, America's for sale. That, to me, has always been the issue with the Clintons, and that wasn't even the email servers and the classification. It was always the corruption. Now, we never asked the question, why did they set up that separate email server system in the first place? She probably knew it was going to get her into trouble. Why did they bother? Was it, you know, who were they worried about? Because it was well before Benghazi that the system was set up. I've always thought that the system was set up to mask whatever the relationship might be between donations from foreign countries and foreign companies and foreign individuals to the Clinton Foundation, mm-hmm. and then special favors they would get from either Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Senator Hillary Clinton, or potentially President Hillary Clinton.
Sadly, we may not see some of those emails until the very last moment, like literally a couple of days before the election. Katie McFarland, thank you so much.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. Listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
We're talking about the Olympics and a couple of incidents that occurred, one with Gabby Douglas, where she did not put her hand over her heart, and some have criticized her for it. She's apologized, said no disrespect. The other one was Michael Phelps cracking up because Baltimore Oriole fans in the stands in Rio did that thing that they always do where it gets to the point where they say, oh, and they yell it really loud as a tribute to the Baltimore Orioles.
On the medal stand, you were close to tears. And then something made you break out in laughter. What happened?
My boys from Baltimore were down at the other end, and back in Maryland, we all say, oh, they're for the Orioles during the part of the national anthem. And all of a sudden, I hear them roar, oh. And I knew exactly where it came from, and I just lost it because those guys came down from Baltimore and New York City to be here, and it's just special to see those guys in the stands.
And I think that's it's time for that to stop. I feel very strongly about that. That's disrespectful.
I do agree with you. The Orioles thing really does bug me, and here's why. It happens in the middle of the national anthem, right toward the end, actually, where they say, oh, say does that Star-Spangled Banner still wave.
Right.
And so they yell a big oh. And why are they doing it? Because of the allegiance of their team, the Orioles, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the problem.
This is the moment when we all,
as Americans, are making a unified statement about our country. You hear this resounding oh, where everyone is saying, I'm with the Orioles. Well, okay, that's fine. Save that for the game. This is the minute and a half where we're all pledging our affinity as Americans united behind our flag and our country. So I do have a problem with that.
And by the way, Baltimore people ought to know better. I mean, where was the song written? The poem was written by Francis Scott Key.
Yep.
In Baltimore.
And by the way, and well, that's the thing. Baltimoreans, they believe they own the Star-Spangled Banner or something because it happened on their watch. By the way, someone on Twitter reminds me, and he's absolutely right, Caps fans need to stop yelling red when they get to Rockets' red glare. That's mm-hmm. also, again, they're trying to do this to their fan allegiance. This is the one moment where we all get together and play and show our allegiance to our nation, not our team. Give it a break.
Yeah, how about John in Rockville? You're on with Brian and Larry. Good morning.
Well, I think you guys hit on it. I disagree with you. Baltimoreans have the unwritten right to,
No, they don't.
Because they was the birthplace of the national anthem.
I don't care. That's not a good excuse to be disrespectful at a time when we're supposed to be paying tribute to our country.
Well, it's an unwritten rule that they have, so they're allowed to
do it. Yeah, it's an unwritten rule. It doesn't mean it's right.
Well, it is to those who didn't write it.
All right. I love these unwritten rules. Are there any other unwritten rules that I need to know about, John, coming out of Baltimore?
See you guys.
All right, John. He's not going to. How about Chris in Annapolis? Chris, good morning. You're on with Brian and Larry. What do you think there, Chris?
Going to the first game, O's game I went to was against Detroit. My dad, as a little kid, you heard it. So, of course, everybody who grew up here don't find it offensive. But if you do find it offensive, I would say you should get equally as offensive as before the Star Spangled Banner is completed. People start clapping and cheering. You know, I think if you should be quiet through the whole thing. But you
well,
know, I think that's acceptable.
I actually believe you should
and
sing it.
Also,
that's what I believe you should do.
And then one last point: if you're getting offended by that, I mean, I think people from different regions have different things. You, Brian, you know, you had this whole thing about the way to pronounce Thanksgiving. You being from Texas.
Chris in Annapolis makes a very good point.
Well, hold on. No, he makes no point at all.
I'm rethinking my whole position. It is not disrespectful
for me to say Thanksgiving instead of Thanksgiving.
See, but you at least admit now that you do pronounce it differently.
I pronounce it the way I was raised to pronounce it, but it's
a thing.
There's a difference. There's no disrespect when I say that. There's disrespect to the national anthem when you interrupt it.
I don't know if that's a regional dialect thing in the Star Spangled Banner. I mean, listen, there are some people from Baltimore who don't do that, right?
It's a regional. No, I'm from Annapolis, but it's a regional thing where people in this area who support the O's, and I think there's patriotism in it too. I don't think it's all about the O's. It's definitely a big part.
No,
but I think they appreciate the singer,
right.
And at that point, it's the O's and America all in one.
I just love that this little thing happened during the medal ceremony at the Olympics with Gabby Douglas not putting her hand on her heart, and we have now made it an indictment on the city of Baltimore.
Yeah, that's right.
And to me, that's a successful Mornings on the Mall right there. Mike in Baltimore, real fast, because we've been hard on Baltimore. We want Baltimore to have a voice here. Go ahead, Mike.
Go ahead, Mike.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you guys for validating the way I have felt for years. I'm from Baltimore, and I'm as big an Oriole fan as anybody up there. But I've always thought there was a very Yahoo way of coming off. I'm embarrassed.
All right, Mike. Mike in Baltimore, the reasonable mind and voice of Baltimore.
There's at least one.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live on 105.9 FM WMAL.